seems like he's been our senator forever, and we wish him well in his next endeavor, which is with God above.
Alaskans say goodbye to Ted Stevens. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, the 17th of August. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the Anchorage Baptist Temple prepares for tomorrow's memorial service.
We had a quick staff meeting that said, all right, this is going to happen, and it might take a few extra hours, a few little extra elbow grease here and there, but let's make it work.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance has a simple request. If you smoke, take it outside. Smoking hurts more than just you. Secondhand smoke increases the risk of coronary heart disease and kills nearly 50,000 non-smoking Americans every year. Smoking around your kids causes chronic and life-threatening diseases and is linked to sudden infant death syndrome. If you choose to smoke, make a choice that protects others who don't. Take it outside. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
At 9:30 this morning, the body of Senator Ted Stevens arrived at All Saints Episcopal Church in downtown Anchorage for a public visitation that will continue until 8 this evening. As APRN's Libby Casey reports, hundreds of people are paying their respects to Stevens today, a mix of those who knew him well and those who respected him as senator.
The small All Saints Episcopal Church sits nestled beneath the tall buildings of downtown Anchorage, some of which bear the handprint of Ted Stevens. A steady stream of mourners walked in, despite overcast skies that sometimes opened up into rain.
Well, the heavens are crying.
Beverly Moore is a Korean War veteran from Anchorage. At 80, she's only a few years younger than Ted Stevens, but remembers going to Washington about 10 years ago for the dedication of the Women's Veterans Memorial and stopping in at his office.
I was like a long-lost daughter when I went in there because he said, if there's any problem, just call me. So, you know, and then I got a couple of letters from him about my service and thanking me. So they're all mementos right on my scrapbook. And his picture is on my fireplace.
Inside the church, Moore and others could take a moment before the closed casket bearing the body of Ted Stevens. It was draped with the American flag and flanked by an honor guard and the flags of the U.S. Senate. Stevens' family sat in a front pew and stood in the back of the church, sharing handshakes or hugs with all who entered. It was quiet and still. After paying his respects, Jeff Cook remembered being 10 years old in the 1950s when he met Ted Stevens. He wore on his funeral suit a vintage Stevens campaign button.
That's about a 24-year-old pin, and I've had it in a drawer, and sometimes you wonder why, but now I know.
Cook wiped his eyes before recalling happy times, like when Mount Redoubt Volcano blew in 1989, canceling flights, and he drove from Fairbanks to Anchorage with the senator.
8 hours with this guy, and we talked about family, faith, friends, international politics, national politics, and just got to know each other. We got to Wasilla, it was snowing real hard, and I look over and I said, there's a jogger, Senator. And he says, you idiot, that's a moose. And we went right by a moose. And the next day he told that story at Anchorage Chamber. So, and then he wrote me a card. Yep, typical. Here's a guy, 5 days before Christmas, writes me a 2-page card thanking me for the ride, telling me I knew more about the Stevens family than anybody should know, and that he hoped someday I'd learn to tell the difference between a moose and a jogger.
That personal touch was on the minds of many friends, like David Monson of Fairbanks. When his wife, the famed dog musher Susan Butcher, died from leukemia 4 years ago, the Stevens family surrounded him with help and support. Now he's doing the same for them, one of scores of helpers. When Monson's wife died, Ted Stevens gave him a book about grieving. He, too, had lost a wife in a 1978 plane crash.
He understood what it meant to go through when you lose somebody that you love, and he had made it his point to go to people that he loved and cared about and share his experience, which is not the Senator Stevens that I think most people think of when they think of him.
Mourners shared story after story. Help Stevens gave one family adopting a baby from Korea, the baby now 26 years old, the senator trying to help a church member with a visa problem. Lulu Swan was a teenage intern for Stevens in Washington in 1992. She says there weren't many other young Inupiaq women from Kivalina around, but she still felt at home, thanks to Stevens.
It's been surreal, knowing that he's gone and kind of tough for me because, you know, he impacted me in a small way, but it's, sorry, just his ability to relate to someone like me.
For some, it's not just saying goodbye to a man, but an era. 81-year-old Carol Phillips was friends with Ted and his first wife, Anne, decades ago, and has outlived most of the founders of the state.
Some of them sat in my kitchen in Nenana and drank coffee with us. You don't forget those people. So it is a passing of an era, but we just hope that those who come along will remember history because it does repeat itself.
That history brought Grace White and her daughter Minnie, who's a teenager at Service High School.
Yeah, I've heard a lot of him. I did Alaska history, and there was a lot of Ted Stevens in it.
Grace White first saw the senator when she was her daughter's age.
I wanted to see him for the last time.
Some said despite the sudden and violent nature of Stevens' death, they feel like he went out on top, in fishing waders, in the land he loved so much. Jan and Peter Rica of Anchorage were like many paying respects who didn't know Stevens well, but called him their senator.
He's done so much for the state that we just wanted to honor him and his family.
Yes, Ted is, you know, he seems like he's been our senator forever, and we wish him well in his next endeavor, which is with God above. So goodbye, Ted.
In Anchorage, I'm Libby Casey.
The public visitation at All Saints Episcopal Church continues until 8 p.m., at which point a motorcade procession will take the body of Senator Ted Stevens to the Anchorage Baptist Temple for tomorrow's service. That event is expected to draw thousands of people, filling up the church's auditorium, gyms, and classrooms. And as APRN's Annie Fite reports, staff and volunteers are busy preparing.
At lunchtime, people filed up to the second-floor church offices at the Anchorage Baptist Temple with questions or special requests. Kathy Luxinger did not come empty-handed. She carried a wicker basket with a massive flag folded neatly inside. And it isn't just any flag. According to Luxinger, it's the last 49-star display-sized flag in Alaska.
And so I'm trying to get to the right people to make sure it's supposedly going to be displayed in the VIP room.
The flag was flown for a year before Hawaii became a state, making it obsolete. Luxinger's parents originally owned the flag and wanted it displayed at as many historic events in Alaska as possible. Luxinger has been persistent, in her own words, working to have it shown at Stevens Memorial Service.
It's only important to me because I feel that it's an honor for the flag to be displayed with Ted Stevens since he was so influential to getting statehood and to supporting Alaskans. I'm not sure it was important to my mothers because they were Democrats, but as I explained to Reverend Clary, the flag is non-denominational, so it can be displayed anywhere.
Luxinger says she doesn't like to let the flag out of her sight, but for this event, she's making an exception.
It just didn't occur to me that the vice president would be here, and it was obvious then that I couldn't enforce what I wanted, which was to be with it.
Those security concerns have helped make organizing the memorial service a logistical challenge. Daryl Nelson is the junior high youth pastor at Anchorage Baptist Temple. He says another big challenge is that there's no way to predict how many people will attend.
You know, you could have anywhere from 1,000 to 5,000, and we really just don't know. So the logistics of how to handle 5,000 people, if that's how many show up, is kind of the hardest thing, and just preparing for that, not knowing if they're actually going to show.
The church auditorium holds around 2,000 people. Nelson says another 2,000 can be accommodated in overflow gyms and classrooms, where they'll be able to watch a live television feed. Nelson says the church has had a lot of help getting ready.
Our last count was 325 volunteers from the church.
And Nelson says there are no shortage of jobs for those volunteers.
Anything from driving buses to ushering to tear down, set up, clean up, just overall fire putter outers, you know, just kind of helping the facility to be represented as best as possible.
Nelson says the Anchorage Baptist Temple was honored when the Stevens family asked to hold the memorial service in their church.
We knew it was a possibility, but really, we didn't think it was going to happen, to be honest. But when it went through, we had a quick staff meeting that said, all right, here's what we have to do. You know, this is going to happen, and it might take a few extra hours, a little extra elbow grease here and there, but let's make it work. And you know, because of such the honor of who Senator Stevens was to this state and what he's done for this state, just to be able to honor him and celebrate his life with this ceremony.
The service will begin at 2 p.m. tomorrow. There won't be any parking on site, but shuttle service will be available from the Tocatinu Commons Mall parking lot at the intersection of Muldoon and the Glen Highway. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, testing the feasibility of energy-efficient technology in Angoon.
A lot of families struggle, especially during the winter, because our electricity rate is so high.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Grant Station, your fast track to funding, helping identify appropriate grant makers for your organization's programs and projects. On the web at grantstation.com. And by First National Bank Alaska, working shoulder to shoulder with Alaskan businesses for nearly a century. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
A recent review of Endangered Species Act recovery plans finds a lack of a national strategy for incorporating global warming as an extinction threat. The review was undertaken by biologist Anthony Povilaitis, the director of Arizona-based LifeNet Nature and the Center for Biological Diversity. Povilaitis says only about 5% of the plans written before 2005 indicate climate change as a threat, even though global warming is the greatest overarching threat for endangered species. He says there was an uptick in numbers between 2005 and 2008, saying that now 60% of the plans include climate change factors, indicating a growing recognition of global warming in recovery planning. But he says many endangered species still don't have recovery plans in place.
There is a crisis out there. Wildlife is going to suffer. Part of our message was to encourage the federal government, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, which is responsible for recovery plans, to move swiftly to grant these species recovery plans. And, of course, as part of that, addressed the climate change issue.
Povilaitis says the federal government is reluctant to implement plans that may affect national policy on greenhouse gas emissions. He says the preliminary documents that will eventually lead to a recovery plan for the polar bear do not mention climate change.
The focus is totally on trying to compensate by reducing the number of bears that are killed in conflict with humans, as opposed to addressing the fact that the bear is losing its sea ice. And that needs to change, or ultimately the bear won't survive.
But U.S. Fish and Wildlife spokesman Bruce Woods says recovery plans are dynamic and can be amended, and often are. He says a good example is the plan for stellar and spectacled eiders, which included a captive breeding program.
And the initial intent was to relocate those birds from the captive breeding plan into the YK Delta, where they had been extirpated. But as we've watched and predicted the impacts of climate change in that area, we may have to reconsider where we relocate those birds, because the habitat that they formerly occupied might not be appropriate by the time we're ready to relocate them.
And Rosa Meehan, head of the Marine Mammals Division, says addressing the broader issue of climate change in a recovery plan would be a miss, because it's global and you can't get there through a species plan. But she says although the problem is large, it doesn't have to be overwhelming.
What I see is that we've got a very specific role to play. It's something that we do as a matter of steps. And if you keep working on putting steps together, you start covering some distance. And I mean, we're not in this. It's not a sprint, you know. I mean, this is going to be a marathon trying to address this stuff. There's a lot of different places where people can play important roles. And so rather than throw up one's hands about, oh, my God, there's so much going on, it's like jump in, do what you can, and hope others come along with you.
The study, Addressing Climate Change Threats to Endangered Species in U.S. Recovery Plans, was published in Conservation Biology. Officials from the Military, Indian Health Service, Veterans Affairs, and the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services have been traveling Alaska to find ways to improve federal delivery of health care services, particularly in rural Alaska. Last week, they visited Anchorage, Fairbanks, Kotzebue, the Kenai Peninsula, and Nome, and villages in northwest and southwest Alaska. Jacqueline Estes of member station KMBA has more.
Veterans Affairs Assistant Secretary for Congressional and Legislative Affairs Joan Evans says the country has 24 million veterans, 8 million are enrolled with the VA, and 5 million use VA benefits. That's about 20% of the people eligible, a trend, she says, that seems to hold true for Alaska as well.
We've learned a tremendous amount walking throughout the villages, learning about veterans who may not know about the benefits that they've been entitled to based on their honorable service.
Veterans are eligible for a wide range of benefits, everything from health care and help with home loans to hiring preference. Alaska Native Brotherhood Grand President Willard Jackson is a tribal council member for Ketchikan Indian Corporation, which provides local health services. He says VA benefits help tribal health organizations stretch their limited budgets and improve services. As a volunteer, he helps veterans access VA benefits.
I talk to men and women that have served in the service. I help them process their claims with the VA, whether that be pension, whether that be compensation, service-connected or non-service-connected. Everyone's eligible one way or another.
Evan says the VA sees a need to place a full-time coordinator in Alaska to help reach out to veterans and educate them about benefits. Begich says in addition to more outreach, the VA should consider pilot programs. For instance, he would like to see the VA integrate its systems with others that are available in rural Alaska.
If a veteran is out in a small village and there's a clinic across the street run by maybe the tribal consortium, they don't have to fly all the way to Anchorage to get the physical that they need. They can go right across the street from a very highly qualified service center, get the physical, and then have the VA reimburse them rather than having to fly everywhere to try to figure out where their services are.
A VA network director, James Floyd of the Creek Nation of Oklahoma, works with the secretary of the VA to establish an Office of Tribal Government Relations. He says agencies are working to increase their capabilities, but there are some things that veterans need and federal agencies cannot provide.
Well, one thing that I think is very important is the sense of family and community, the resolve that people have. You know, I think that's universal throughout Indian country, communities that can come together or families that can come together and be strong is a great support for people and helps sustain, especially the veterans in coming back home.
VA staff told a group of healthcare providers from across Alaska that they work with the Department of Defense on a daily basis so people can move from active duty to veteran status more smoothly and so that benefits such as healthcare will be better coordinated. Senator Begich formed the groups, which are to report their findings to Congress by September 23rd. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Jacqueline Estes.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. And by Northrim Bank, helping you get from where you are to where you want to be. Achieve more. Northrim Bank for Business. Information at northrim.com. Member FDIC.
A home in Angoon is getting a $100,000 retrofit to test energy-efficient technology. Southeast tribal and environmental groups hope the house will show that solar, wind, and other upgrades are practical for Southeast villages. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
Angoon, like most diesel-dependent villages, is struggling with the high cost of energy. It's trying to build a hydropower plant to generate electricity, but that's several years off.
a lot of families struggle, especially during the winter, because our electricity rate is so high. Also, oil to heat our houses is really high.
Marcy Kukesh works for the Angoon Business Center. It's one of the groups trying an alternative approach to reducing village energy costs. The organizations recently chose the home of Peggy and Kelly Williams for a power-saving demonstration project.
There's a big group who checked out all the different houses, and they picked the house that was chosen because it's kind of in a really good location where the sun shines down during most of the day.
The small house is typical of many in Angoon and other southeast villages. Dan Lesh, energy coordinator for the Southeast Alaska Conservation Council, says it has outdated appliances, inadequate insulation, and other energy wasters. The project aims to fix all that.
We're going to be removing the siding and putting on a whole new layer of rigid foam. We'll be replacing a lot of the appliances within the house.
SEAC and the Business Center are partnering with the Tlingit-Haida Regional Housing Authority and others to retrofit the home.
And we'll be installing, and already have installed, energy management equipment that'll help the occupant know how much energy is being used. And there'll be solar panels and a solar hot water system. And we're also going to be testing out a small wind generator.
The goal is to reduce energy costs 65%. The project is pegged at about $105,000. That's far more than most village residents could afford, even with help from tribal and other government energy rebate programs. Lesh says the sponsoring groups know that, but they expect the project will help them understand which energy-saving elements work best in Southeast.
We're testing out technologies that may not ultimately be cost-effective in this setting, but you know that calculus changes with different government programs, and if you look over a longer time scale where you're trying to get paid back, you can justify more upfront expense.
Work will begin in early September. Sponsors will document the effort and produce an educational film in hopes of inspiring others to try similar energy-saving approaches.
Potentially, this project we're hoping will expand into an outreach, an educational component that includes LED light bulbs replacement throughout the region.
Organizers say replacing bulbs in Angoon homes could save 430,000 gallons of diesel a year. Further efforts in Hoona, Cake, Klukwan, and the Chilkat Valley could save 2.5 million gallons of diesel. This is Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau.
Dr. Thomas Grams was one of 10 humanitarian workers massacred in an ambush in Afghanistan earlier this month. Thomas Grams was a Durango, Colorado dentist who traveled with the ill-fated medical team. Grams worked with Global Dental Relief, an organization that sent dental teams around the world. His twin brother lives in Anchorage. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer has more.
Dr. Grams is survived by two brothers in Alaska. One of them is his twin, Tim Grams. Tim Grams spoke from Bemidji, Minnesota, where he is with family while awaiting the return of Dr. Grams's body for funeral services. Tim Grams says that his brother got involved in working in remote areas of the world when he happened to meet an Afghani victim of torture about 9 years ago. Dr. Grams offered to fix the man's broken teeth.
Through this gentleman, he met a number of other Afghanis from the Albuquerque community. There's a pretty good sized number of Afghans down there. So he made quite a few friends with the Afghan community down there. And concurrent with that, he had also been working with the Global Dental Relief Organization. After he got interested in Afghanistan, he connected with an organization called Kids for Afghan Kids. He went to a village in southern Afghanistan in the Pashtun territories.
He says his brother would stay for several weeks in the Afghani villages, and he returned there four times.
He gained the confidence of the people in the village. You know, initially, he was treating the men and the boys, and eventually became more boys and a few girls. And by the time he was there, his fourth trip, he was seeing, you know, families, the wives, and of course, in the Islamic culture, that's about as high a level of trust as you can get when the men allow their wives to be seen by a Western man. So he was, very much loved by the villagers in that village. And, they went to great efforts to protect him. And he stopped going there when the village leader basically told him, now there's too many foreigners running around. We can't ensure your safety anymore.
Tim Graham says Dr. Grams did not get paid by the humanitarian groups he worked for, paying for his airfare with frequent flyer miles and more often than not buying his own supplies.
His involvement wasn't just going to these countries and working with the people. When he was in the States, he would go to the thrift stores and either buy like used shoes or sweaters or a clothing appropriate for Afghanistan, and then he would mail it to one of the aid organizations over there.
Tim Grams also spent time in Afghanistan. He flew helicopters for the Alaska Air National Guard, and he served 2 4-month terms there with the National Guard. The two brothers crossed paths at Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan at one time because Dr. Grams was picking up some supplies he had mailed there.
It was much cheaper to send it through the U.S. postal system, so he would send it to my APO address at Bagram, and I was getting all these boxes while I was there, and I had, a Toyota Land Cruiser full of boxes by the time he showed up to pick them up. And I was really worried he was going to have a big enough vehicle to get all these boxes into the vehicle and get them back to the NGO that he was working with to get them distributed. But he managed to get through all the security checkpoints there at Bagram, and we met for about 10 minutes at Bagram, and he got the boxes and off he went.
The 10 medical workers were allegedly killed by the Taliban. The Taliban has taken credit for the murders, saying that the victims were trying to convert local people to Christianity. Although Dr. Grams worked most recently with the International Assistance Mission, a Christian-based relief organization, Tim Graham says he was not a religious man.
He would never, ever have gone with a group that he even suspected of trying to proselytize in Afghanistan. So I think it's just a blatant lie by the extremists to justify their actions.
He says his brother was well aware of Islamic prohibitions.
There was absolutely, positively, unequivocally no way that he was doing any proselytizing. I mean, he was very aware of Islamic law, that it was a capital offense to try to convert, a Muslim into another religion. He knew it was an Afghani law. He never carried any religious material with him. He respected the cultures of all the countries he visited.
Tim Graham says the incident is being investigated by the FBI as an international terrorist act. Dr. Graham's body has been flown back to the United States, although federal officials are holding the body until further investigation can be completed. Tim Graham says there will be memorial services for his brother in Durango, Colorado, and later this month in Minnesota. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. You'll also find pictures, audio slideshows, and video of the remembrances for Senator Ted Stevens. You can follow us on Twitter at aprn. We had reports tonight from Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau and Jacqueline Estes and Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage. APRN's Libby Casey also reported from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
First National Bank Alaska, serving Alaskans' financial needs for nearly a century. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender. 90% of those who drown in boating accidents in Alaska are men. To get men to wear their life jackets, have them fill out a Pledge to Live card and make a promise to wear their life jacket every time they get in a boat. Every time. Most men won't listen to messages like this, but they might listen to you. Go to pledgetolive.org to get a card or find one at your local car Safeway. Make them promise so they make it back alive. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety Program.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.